Out of the blue, on a September morning, Lisa Curran took a phone call saying she had been named one of the MacArthur Fellows for 2006. Winners of these so-called genius grants from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation receive $500,000 in unrestricted funding over 5 years. It allows them to pursue interests that have already established them as some of the leading thinkers and doers in the world. They are always surprised by the news.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Lisa Curran is a professor at the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale University. She is an expert in tropical forest ecology and its intersection with human populations. She has spent almost 20 years in the forests of Borneo, Indonesia, building a reputation as an effective and beloved mentor of women scientists in Indonesia, the U.S., and elsewhere. I'm Melinda Tuhus. I interviewed Lisa Curran in her office in an old building called the Greenhouse at Yale School of Forestry. How important is mentoring women to you?
I'm in a field that is dominated by men, especially logging camps in Indonesia. So I always insisted that I have female counterparts for lots of reasons. I mean, one, it was a joyous time to work together. I've worked with some women for over 18, 20 years in Indonesia, and they're like sisters to me. And I've, you know, gone through their weddings and births of their children and what have you. So we just feel like that's a bigger family. Secondly, that most of the people that run projects are men, and there's not a lot of opportunities for women. So I found that when I had the opportunity, that I would insist that women have also similar opportunities. And also, I was recently tenured here, and there's all men. I'm the only tenured woman faculty, and I had 12 years of an Ivy League institution, you know, education without ever having a woman professor. And my students often, I have a lot of women graduate students, and they're looking at, I wouldn't say mentors per se, but examples of people that have found their own way to do things. And, you know, I've never heard a guy ask how to combine a career and a family, and I hear that question constantly, whether it's in Indonesia or Brazil or Belize or the U.S.
Now, I know an awful lot of women who are graduate students at the forestry school. Do you know what the ratio of men to women is now?
Females are the majority, surprisingly, and it's just recently surpassed. I know when I was an undergraduate at Harvard, my class had 1,600 and there were 400 women, and now at Yale and Harvard, as well as the forestry school, women make up the majority of students, and maybe 53% or more, but it certainly has changed here.
And you recently got tenured here, and you're the only woman tenured faculty member at the School of Forestry, is that right?
Yes, the way promotion works here, you're not tenured until you're a full professor. So in 100 years of the school, there's been a total of 2 women full professors. Since I've been here, we've had a number of women hires as assistant professors. So they're in the pipeline, so to speak. They call it the leaky pipeline, especially in science. I mean, when I was an undergraduate at Harvard Radcliffe, I was part of the National Organization of Women, and there were women rights type marches on Washington that I participated in. And, I think that part of it is to understand where are the bottlenecks or the constraints when people are making choices. The one thing that strikes me is still back to childcare, dual career couples, to the I would say almost the male culture of the field, in the sense that I'd prefer to be a lot more collaborative and cooperative, and it's much more competitive than most folks, men and women, sometimes want to participate in. So I'm really grateful to have played sports in high school and college, and to be part of a diverse team, like as a point guard, where you can have a great game but your team loses. And so I think part of that is sort of to nurture and bring out the different components of a team, and it's really served me well in terms of running a lab or having a field team that we're all trying to work for a common goal, and how are we going to coordinate the different personalities and talents as well as idiosyncrasies of a certain individual or groups. Certainly the MacArthur Award, I think playing by the mainstream was already dominated by very aggressive and powerful individuals, and you sort of see a way to pull different aspects together to solve a problem, which may or may not be, you know, an asset in some situations, but certainly the MacArthur validated, you know, a non-traditional path.
In your field, I mean, forest ecology is an example of collaboration and cross-fertilization, and it seems like it would be hard to be in the field unless one was of a collaborative nature. So do you feel like your work here at Yale is able to be fairly collaborative, or do you feel like it's much more sort of hierarchical and you're sort of, everybody's out for themselves?
Well, that's a tricky thing to answer. In some ways, I'm highly collaborative, but not necessarily with colleagues from Yale. My collaborations are with, you know, a remote sensing satellite specialist at the University of Maryland, or someone who's a modeler from Stanford. And in some cases, we find synergy here because someone is working on corruption and governance from the policy aspect. Someone's looking at timber certification, and I'm looking at how it plays out in Indonesia. And so we can see a natural grouping around a topic. But that said, I think, you know, one of the things that you have to do to achieve tenure and is to get a name for yourself is to really publish and do your own independent work, not necessarily have points for being a congenial colleague. You know, in the end, it's sort of deeds, not words, and actually what's assessed. And the assessment is what you produce. So if you produce it with your colleagues, great. If you produce it with folks, colleagues from outside the institution, that's fine as well.
I'm speaking with Lisa Curran, a groundbreaking forest ecologist and mentor of women in the field.
So let's talk a little bit about your work in Indonesia. It sounds like you spent a lot of time hiking in the rainforest and spending time with hundreds of men in logging camps. And so just can you describe a typical day, and how much of the year do you spend in environments like that?
It's changed over time. So initially I went out as post-undergraduate, and I was signed onto a project that we were setting up a large research area in what is now a national park. And so I went out with a team, there were four or five guys and myself, and we built the camp, cut the trails, set up the plots. So an early morning would be rise out of your tent, 4 a.m, drink your coffee, and get out and hike for 3 or 4 hours up to an area and census the wildlife, the birds and the animals, mammals that you'd see, and then set up plots, study plots of the vegetation, and then monitor those plots. And I did that for about 8 years.
And you said this was post-undergraduate, so this is right after you graduated from college?
I was about 22, 23 years old. I had, I often tell students, be careful what you sign on to. For my undergraduate thesis, I went out to Nepal and did a study similar to this myself for about 6 months. And when I was finished university, I decided I wanted to sign on for a year or two to learn more skills. And it was a lovely camp, and then there were a number of visiting scientists. And so I worked there for several years before I went back to graduate school to do my PhD. So I was blessed in that I was able to walk around these gorgeous forests, and I worked on the major timber trees and their biology and understand these amazing cycles where they all synchronize their fruiting only with El Nino. So I was been able to show it because of this long-term work. But those were the major timber trees that were being logged all over Borneo. So I not only learned all these species and their fruits and their seedlings and sort of knew the natural history really well, I understood how they functioned in part of the ecosystem. So when I did my dissertation work at Princeton University, I combined it with work in the protected area with work in a logging camp. And it was the first time, this was in the early 90s, the first time a Westerner had ever really started to work in a logging camp in Indonesia. Now, I spoke the language, I knew the forest really well, so I was somewhat accepted into this region. And I lived in under a blue tarp with a, you know, kerosene lantern. And people were laughing now. They say, oh, you use up so much carbon by flying all over the planet. And I said, well, you know, I lived for 10 years without a car, electricity, using gas, and never had a television. So can I use some carbon credits from the early part of my life? For now, I fly around everywhere. So I was blessed with that, and then I started working in that timber camp, understanding the motivations and the work, but from an ecological perspective, what was the impact of logging on these forests? And after that, I signed on and I started working for the U.S. Agency for International Development, where I was the forestry advisor. I was a young punk, like and with all guys, and it was a $36 million project, so you had access. Before, I was working in these smaller sites with small grants, and now you're able to talk to the Minister of Forestry and the Minister of Land Use Planning in Indonesia. So that's when I did a very large concession study where I lived in 18 different logging camps, and I was affectionately known as the bottom feeder because I would find out all these details and information of what motivated and how companies were cheating. I used to write memos on, you know, how they cut outside blocks and how they manipulated the forestry laws. And most of the consultants on USAID, or those folks, are based in the capital city, staying in five-star hotels trying to influence policy. So it was very useful experience. I interacted with the forest economists and policymakers and folks, and basically said, this is how your policies are translated in practice on the ground. And many of these people never leave, you know, a five-star hotel and are writing these things. So it was also a reality check for a lot of folks. I brought a few of them to the field.
Well, I know in some countries, people who do what you were doing would end up being dead. Was that ever a concern?
Yes. A couple of things. I mean, when we talk about women's issues, I'm very sensitive to the fact that I'm a Westerner and I can leave. And one of my first research assistants, a woman who is one of the leaders in human rights and women's issues in Indonesia, Yeni Damiante, she was arrested and thrown in jail at 23 for 6 months in jail, and she became a sort of a poster child for Amnesty International. But her charge was insulting President Suharto. I mean, we worked under a military dictatorship who didn't want this information to be known. I think a lot of folks think about logging and things in the U.S., but it's very different there. It was a part of political patronage, and these concessions were given out to military generals and backers of the regime as sort of, you know, little prizes that they could use. So when I was younger and we were doing these studies, I was somewhat overly optimistic and naive that information would change things, not really understanding about power and resources and how they're played out. Became more sophisticated in this and found that there were allies and people trying to change things. And in every institution, there's always the younger, more vibrant folks who want to change things, others who are more seasoned and can, as I figure I've now come to middle age, this is where I get to where you try to. The young folks are the protesters, get you to the table, and as you get older and more accomplished, you tend to be the ones who try to fix things. You know, there's the radical reformers, and we're more like technical tinkerers now. And then those things happen through an evolution of changing minds slowly. Yes, there's been a lot of times when either my teams, we had, you know, death threats, or we were extorted or held beyond, you know, without our consent, and at one point it became very dangerous for me. Early on, with a military regime, or at least with a centralized corruption, you can predict the chain of who's in charge. And after the fall of Suharto in 99, it became decentralized corruption, which means there's little mafiosos everywhere you go, and you can just be in the wrong place at the wrong time. It was basically people scrambling for resources. So I went, several times in my career, I've tried to leave Indonesia, and somehow it brought me back for whatever reasons. But that's one of the reasons I started working in Brazil at a time when it was just too dangerous to go back. And I didn't want to jeopardize my field staff or teams, families, and their own livelihoods, because I could leave the country. I'm very much aware, as I mentioned earlier, of my role is to provide information, but this is their country and they have to change things. I just don't want to make it difficult for their daily lives. And, you know, sometimes it has been.
Well, just briefly, after Suharto left office, is the level of corruption, would you say, just as bad, and the danger to threats to the lives and livelihoods of the people you work with, you yourself and the people you work with, has that improved at all?
Yes, it has. I mean, there's a difference between having laws and enforcing laws and rules of law. It certainly was. I was very optimistic when the new democratically elected president, SBA, President Susilo, was back in office in October 20th of 2004. So I returned to Indonesia then, and he made illegal logging, corruption, and land use his 100-day agenda, and that was part of a long-term social movement of students and non-governmental organizations, and So I was optimistic that the window was open for change, as many of us were, and so it was a good time when we saw changes in terms of enforcement, independent judiciaries, freedom of the press, and that some very higher ranking officials, rather than the locals who are collecting the logs, who are paying very little, but they're doing illegal activities, and a middleman or the upper boss is making all the money, is essentially that there was a lot more pressure to clean this up. And then the tsunami hit. I had left Indonesia 2 days before Christmas, and I have since been incredibly brokenhearted because the momentum was there for a lot of change, and then there were situations in Indonesia that required a refocusing, obviously, of efforts toward rebuilding Aceh.
This is Lisa Curran, one of the 2006 MacArthur Fellows, recipient of a so-called Genius Award.
You mentioned, you mentioned the word mafiosi, and I was looking at, you're going to be doing a symposium at Rutgers, University of New Jersey, I guess, called Rutgers, next April. And is this your title? The
Yes.
Mask, the Matrix, and the Mafia. And that caught my eye. So, and then it says, synergistic effects of El Nino and land use change on Bornean ecosystems. It sounds like it would be pretty interesting.
The mast is what we call the synchronized production of all fruit by these timber trees, and it's the most spectacular event ever that I've ever witnessed, and I've witnessed many of them, so that's where I feel blessed, is understanding that all these trees across the entire island of Borneo synchronize fruit. It's like Thanksgiving in the forest. They dump 200 kilos of seed per hectare, and this is a big feast. It's like Thanksgiving, where all of a sudden all the animals come out. You know, instead of turkeys, you have jungle fowl, and you have wild boar. And in New England, we used to have the passenger pigeon, which was 5 billion birds. Essentially, this is the forest produces all of these fruits, everything from mangoes to rambutan. So it's a period of abundance, and it supports local communities as well as the animals, where they all breed during this time. Wild boar go on migrations. It's the largest migration outside of the wildebeest in Africa. Tens of thousands of pigs will move across this landscape to feed on the seed. So on one hand, I witnessed these great events, and then I saw them collapse. And so the matrix is looking at land use in the matrix around large protected areas. And so what was happening outside of the parks, logging and clearing these lands for industrial activities, mostly agribusiness like oil palm plantations, changed this. So instead of the whole island of Borneo fruiting, you now had isolated smaller patches of forest, and the system collapsed. They couldn't swamp all these animals that wanted to eat the seeds, like we're seeing acorns out here with squirrels. And instead, the trees didn't regenerate. Whatever little seed they produced, all of it was eaten. And so then we started to see a collapse of the animal population. So people depend on wild boar. It's their major source of protein for the indigenous people of Borneo. And these people were saying, we used to have thousands of pigs come through here, and now we only see one a month, and there's not. And this was their major source of food. So I witnessed these great abundanzas kind of thing, and then was starting to see it collapse. So I started looking at the matrix, sort of using, that's how I started getting funding from NASA, satellite technologies to scale up from, instead of monitoring a watershed, like Quinnipiac watershed, now I'm measuring like the entire eastern seaboard, and essentially Borneo, the British Isles can fit inside of Borneo. So it's a huge area that we could use remote sensing satellite, like folks can Google Earth, kind of thing, those technologies to map what forest is remaining and what condition it's in. And the mafias were the tycoons and the illegal loggers, and what was basically given out into these concessions. And we were shocked to see how little lowland forest was remaining outside of these big powerful interests. And so looking at their behavior in terms of controlling the big plywood industry. Now, I have to admit, and most people don't know this, but Indonesia was the largest exporter of tropical timber in the world. It was once a $9 billion industry in the mid-90s. So if you go to Home Depot, you used to have tropical plywood, or if you're having chopsticks from a local sushi place, most of this was in this same family of trees that was used to, they're very dense stocking in these forests, and it was used as a commercial product, but low grade. So in the forests of the Congo or in the Amazon, you only take one or two trees per hectare, and they're like mahogany, fancy tables and high-end products. Whereas in Borneo, there are thousands of these trees, hundreds of species, were all used to make plywood, moldings for Japanese construction and what have you. So they were logging this quite heavily, and so part of it was who was making the money and how were they manipulating the regulations to suit these powerful timber tycoons, basically.
So just so I understand, it was human-induced, the collapse, or it was really a natural phenomenon, and then...
Human-induced. Okay. So it was partly of converting... initially, all these concessions were given out by President Suharto. He gave out 60% of the land area of Borneo to these timber concessions, and as they started logging those, they were taking these trees out all over the island, and we were working in a protected area, so it was still relatively intact. So the surprise was the system started to collapse in the protected area, even though that wasn't being logged. And so when we published that, we realized we needed to have the spatial extent and distribution of forests and their conditions. So that's when we started working in the Matrix. And it was just when the Matrix films came out. So I had the Matrix team, and of course I was Trinity, and one of my guys was Neo and Morpheus. But that was our battle cry, I think, because, you know, when I had slides, we're working in the Matrix, which is the messier... not so pretty. It's beautiful to work in a national park and swim in a clear river and live in your camp. It's very different to work in oil palm plantations and degraded logging areas and things like that.
So when you were awarded the MacArthur Award, just tell me a little bit about what the committee said in choosing you and the work that you're doing and why, you know, apparently they thought that was worth honoring and rewarding.
It's all confidential. So I really don't know. I only know what they wrote in the write-up that's public on the MacArthur website. And I think part of that that was striking is that, you know, when you present these talks, it requires a cultural sensitivity. It's very different working in Asia and, you know, as a Westerner, you're always an outsider. So how do you do this in a right way? Secondly, the types of information, since it's not publicly available, you have to use creative means to collect different types of data. So, for example, you know, how much wood is being consumed by plywood mills or who's doing what. So we combined very technical science with good old-fashioned sleuthing, in some cases to beg, borrow, and steal data sets that were useful. I think the creative part comes into trying to solve a problem and see what is the best means, given the limitations that we have, to use proxy data, as we could say. You know, we can't measure a lot of things directly, so what can we use, or what kind of a study can we design in a short term to generate reasonable results? And I think that's the difference. A lot of scientists, and I've been publicly criticized for not sticking with just being an ecologist. And so, very recently as well, and so part of that was, you know, you're a non-traditional person, people want you to be more in the mainstream, and there was like, well, why don't you stick to doing your really solid science? And I said to someone, well, if your entire study site is destroyed and the bulldozers show up and all of this is gone, would you use your skills and talents to help solve a problem that everyone in Indonesia is always asking me to help with, versus promote a more academic scientific career? So I've had a non-traditional career in terms of an academic. I don't think that's what was, certainly that was recognized in the MacArthur.
So what are you going to do with the money? and yeah, is it, how much is it going to change your life?
It's funny, that question of course is asked immediately when you're still in a state of shock. One, it's not given all at once, thank goodness for me. Two, I never did any of this for money to begin with. What it does, it's delicious freedom to be able to take risks or start new projects or work in a particular area or arena that you don't need to establish yourself and write grant proposals, in my case, to do. So initially, I will be supporting some of my Indonesian women colleagues to continue school, and I think that's the other thing, the privilege of education, a lot of Americans especially take for granted, you know, the cost and expense of university and even just books and what have you. So there's, I always support a lot of the local students and some women who come to the U.S. for master's degrees. There may be some opportunities for that. The second part is there's been a number of Kenyan or Bhutanese scientists that have asked me, would you come and work with us in this project? And I recently had that happen. They want land use with the Maasai between these areas has changed from public-private partnerships, and now I can fly over and help them without requiring any resources, you know, and that feels good because I really don't want to take resources from the new Bhutanese School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, which would like some help with the curriculum. So it frees me up to try some new things and go, but no, I've never really, I mean, if you have to carry everything you own on your back, you realize you're not really into material things, so every once in a while I thought, yeah, I'd like a new dugout canoe, but, you know.
I wanted to ask you one more question, a little more in depth about the women that you work with, because when we had the phone conversation the first time, you told me there were quite a few women, and you talked about it now a little bit, but talk about that a little bit more now, and what role they will play or are playing in their own country, or will they leave?
Mm. They won't leave, certainly not. I think that's, they may leave for a year or two for education purposes to come over, say, for a Yale master's degree, but no, they're there. I think what, in a Muslim, you know, dominated, most populous Muslim nation, you often have fewer opportunities for women, although my colleague Dwi and I, that we've worked together, she's a lecturer in the local university, and you can see the dominant roles that some of the men play, but it's very similar to here. I think competent, and they tend to be quiet women, pursue their goals and move ahead, but slowly. And I think the opportunities that she's had working with me in publications and things certainly enhanced her career as well as mine. I often identify young, talented women and help them with language courses, English. You really will succeed if you can speak English, and that's often been a constraint for many of these women. I supported local women to go to the local schools, and when I work in villages, I usually buy all the school uniforms for all the children in the village, both men and girls and boys, because that's the expense that will often keep a girl out of school, because the family can't afford to send both and the uniforms are expensive. But, you know, that's a drop in the bucket compared to big social issues. It's just that over time, if you do this every year for 25 years, you start to amass a group that, you know, tends to be a more dominant force. And that's what's nice about it. I mean, now I can look back and say, oh, yes, that person's running this project for the World Wildlife Fund or for Conservation International. I gave her her first scholarship to the U.S., or this person's doing that. Yeah, that's basically finding talented people and infusing a little bit of positive support and often an opportunity that they wouldn't have otherwise. No, they would probably succeed in their own right, but this is sort of it may be the one event that changed things for them or not. But certainly they're now an amazing cadre of women who are doing great things in Indonesia.
Lisa Curran is an expert in tropical forest ecology and its intersection with human populations, and one of the MacArthur Fellows for 2006.
I'm Melinda Tuhus, reporting for Wings.
Our email is wings@wings.org. Website, www.wings.org. The Wings Sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle Is Cast. Special thanks to Suzette Cullen and to Genevieve Vaughn, author of 36 Steps to a Gift Economy. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.